Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Pensions Expert podcast. On the show this week, we'll be talking about how Aon and Willis Towers Watson have dropped their merger plans to become the world's biggest insurance broker after the US Department of Justice raised concerns. We'll also discuss whether rushing consolidation of defined contribution schemes could be detrimental to the retirement outcomes of members. And we'll also hear an update on the pensions dashboards and what this all means for the pension sector. Last but not least, we'll look at the implications of the pensions regulator's review of schemes that might be eligible for the fraud compensation fund. My name is Stephanie Baxter. I'm a financial journalist at Rotic Media, and I'm your host for this episode. I'm joined by David Saunders, who is a partner at Sackers, and Kim Gubler, who is chair of the Pensions Administration Standards Association. Thank you both for joining me today. Shall we kick off with our first topic then? This is about Aon and Willis Towers Watson's abandoned merger. The companies announced in March 2020 that they plan to combine their businesses to create the world's biggest insurance broker. But on 26th of July this year, they abandoned their planned £22 billion merger after the US Department of Justice intervened and sued the two companies to block the deal. Now, the merger would have combined their pensions consultancies and fiduciary management businesses, creating a dominant UK player in these sectors. The two companies had agreed to sell several US and German subsidiaries to get the deal approved and receive the assent of the European Commission's competition watchdog. David, if I could start off with you, if that's all right. The US Department of Justice was concerned the transaction would reduce market competition and lead to higher prices. Do you think their views were valid? And also, why did the European regulator give the go-ahead, but the DOJ did not?
Like all of these things, there's two sides to every argument. And clearly, Aon and Willis Towers Watson were keen to present the view, as they did both before and indeed after abandoning the deal, that they believed that what was proposed was going to be in the interests of consumers. Yes, you're right, the EU Commission was persuaded, and these are of course both businesses which are headquartered in the EU. It's important to the EU to have strong organisations functioning within its territories, albeit that I'm sure that was not their primary concern. Their primary concern is, of course, to deal with competition commission concerns. Different regulatory bodies have different views, and obviously the DOJ has reached a different view on market competition compared to the EU's position, and that is what regulatory bodies do. I think what's more relevant is obviously with these deals that there comes a point in time when the parties to them decide that they don't make sense anymore. And clearly, the parties to this transaction have sort of concluded what would be necessary to achieve the assent of the DOJ to withdraw its case. Means that the deal perhaps doesn't make sense for them anymore, either in terms of what it was that they would ask for ultimately in terms of further divestments, or the timetable delays that would be caused by the court case. Which to remind you that Aon and WTW both felt that they would win.
I thought that was quite interesting, actually, that they said seemed confident that they would win the case, that they didn't. Why didn't they just pursue the merger, especially when they had approval from the EU regulator? And also, it's come at a heavy price because Aon must now pay a $1 billion termination fee to Willis Towers Watson. And then I just want to ask you, David, do you think that the merger, if it had gone ahead, would have been a good outcome, a good thing for their pension scheme clients and the wider industry, in your view?
What we certainly won't end up with now is a giant compared to the other UK players. I think that the stats work that something like the combined revenues of WTW and Aon in the UK would have been about 75% bigger than its nearest competitor. So it would have been a very significant thing. And I think we have deep and excellent relationships with both organisations. We would have continued to have, no doubt, excellent relationships with them if they were combined, and we'll continue to have excellent relationships with them as independent organisations. And just like different regulators take different views, I think there are people on different ends of the spectrum on this one as well. There are some people that would have no doubt believed that having an even bigger massive player and the synergies that could have created would have had benefits to it, and there are There are others who will no doubt, you know, welcome the fact that the two will be kept apart, no least because I expect some people will be relieved from the fact they don't have to review their advisors in the result of the fact that, you know, they have sort of WWNA on either sides of the company and trustee advisors, and that they may have needed to think about whether they want to go elsewhere if they combined.
Thank you for that. And Kim, if I could bring you in here, what are your thoughts on this about, you know, the abandoned merger, and whether you think it would have been you know, potentially sort of bad outcome for Aon and Willis Towers Watson's sort of pension scheme clients and the wider industry, and also if we kind of think about, you know, it would have created you know, such a big player and potentially could have reduced competition, you know, well, under what the DOJ said.
I think the first thing you need to think about is what drove this, and it was the risk business. It wasn't the EBC business, the consulting business at all. So it was bringing together the two big risk businesses, and that's essentially what the DOJ was up against. And I don't know how true it is, but my understanding is that the previous administration in the US was pretty keen on the merger, and the current administration is not. So sort of that sort of dropping away of support, I think, was an indicator sort of there. So if you go to looking at sort of what the impact on the UK employee benefit consulting business, it is effectively a secondary or important, but a secondary decision sort of on that. There was quite a lot of alignment. You know, you have to also sort of think about the fact that this was, you know, primarily Aon, you know, with 67%, would have had 67% of the ownership. Most of the, you know, both firms have got very good people across the piece. There would have been some fallout where there was some dual roles personally. And you know, this sort of depends on what hat I'm wearing. But personally, I think having a diverse market is healthy. And so therefore, although I didn't see, you know, I didn't think it would be initially and absolutely detrimental, I think that there's not going to be any harm done by keeping it, you know, the status quo as it is.
Well, thank you both for your thoughts on that topic. And if you go on to our second topic, so this one's about DC consolidation. So under proposed rules from the Department for Work and Pensions, defined contribution schemes with assets under £100 million will have to prove their value for members or face consolidation. This is effectively to improve saver outcomes and put capital towards green technology and infrastructure investments. But some experts, in response to the DWP's consultation, have warned that these proposals go too far too soon and risk eroding the involvement of employers in the retirement outcomes of their workforce. And some have also said that rushing consolidation could even be detrimental to members' retirement outcomes. Kim, what would you sort of make of all this? Do you think that these proposals could affect members' pensions outcomes for the worse if they're rushed too fast, too soon?
Well, I think, again, there's two sides to this. There's consolidation of the under 100 million, and then there's the 100 million to 5 billion question. And I think, although there are still some negative views on the sort of under 100 million, there's a fairly reasonable consensus that there could be better outcomes for members in that space if they transition to a larger body. So before we talk about the sort of 100 to 5 billion, the problem is market capacity in that sense, because if you have everyone going through a similar value for money process at a similar time, and even if 60% of them decided that they couldn't meet those criteria, they've then got to find suppliers in a relatively small market, and relative, you know, not all master trusts would take every potential client scheme as a client on. You know, plus the fact, and one of the things that PASA sort of highlighted in its response, and that goes across both, is, you know, this isn't a simple matter. This involves quite a lot of advice, legal advice, David, I'm sure you would do, investment advice, etc., because this isn't just for future service. So the existing trustees have got to be satisfied that the new vehicle is appropriate in and delivers value for money. So they've got to do their own value for money assessment, their future value for money assessment. They've got to have the legal advice. If it's a master trust that's going to, then the employer's got to have its legal advice. The employer's got to have its advisors to be able to choose a master trust. And again, there has to be sufficient capacity in the market to take that on. And some of those smaller DC schemes may not be attractive. You know, they may have very small sort of assets under management. They might be tricky. They might, you know, nobody's really addressed the, what about the schemes that have got underpins, either, you know, fixed or GMP underpins, because that is a really tricky subject to be able to, you can't just translate those, or certainly not at the moment. So I think there are definitely issues with that, but it's probably in the main a good thing. You know, as long as it is managed and people don't have a short window with which they to do it. When you go for the 100 billion to 5 billion, well, this is when we, you know, we have a different view, because there are a lot of large, you know, 5 billion pounds is a lot of money. There aren't that many DC pension schemes, solely DC pension schemes in the UK that are that big. And there are some pretty good ones of the sort of billion upwards. Actually, I know some that are sort of, you know, around about the 800 million. You know, they're still classed in this immature DC stage as quite large. And so therefore, you know, having to go through pushing consolidation like that, I think, you know, and that's where I agree with the industry view, in that I don't think there's capacity. I don't think it's necessary. There should be some way of identifying those schemes that really should consolidate, and there should be a destination. So if you can't find anything else, they can go there that is gives people value for money, because it's about that quality to sort of delivery. So it's sort of it's a question of two halves again.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, Kim. And I think if you're going to mention that, is there capacity in the master trust market to take on more? You know, a lot of master trusts have just gone through authorization. A lot are still kind of, you know, relatively immature. I mean, what are your thoughts on this, David? And we sort of think about, you know, master trust capacity to take on more schemes, consolidation, and it's all very well, you know, the DWP kind of proposing rules to encourage consolidation, but at the same time, would it even be possible, and would that be in the best interests of members?
Yeah, again, following on from sort of Kim splitting this into two bits of the you know, the sub 100 and those above. I mean, as regarding the sub 100, one of the question marks we would raise is that some of those schemes at that level may already not be complying with some of the legislative requirements that are already in place and expected of them in terms of, you know, doing chair statements, etc., that should be being done. And the question mark is that if those schemes are already not complying, and that might be simply because of ignorance of the law, are they going to be aware and comply with these requirements to create these additional disclosures in their chair statements and go through the necessary process and take the necessary advice that they need to do that? And so, you know, if that is right, you know, and the evidence of the time will tell in terms of whether this does lead indeed to sort of any sort of acceleration in consolidation, then if it doesn't work, then you know, the government may have to think again about compulsion, which obviously it's indicated that it would be, you know, potentially minded to do. I think for those schemes that are equally, you know, are aware of it, that this is coming down the track, I think there's also a potential moral hazard that they will look to put themselves into winding up before the requirements apply to them, because of course what's been clarified now is that if you go into wind up before you have to issue your first chair statement, that these new requirements won't apply to you. And then, you know, will that wind up then be well managed in members' interest to do it properly and efficiently, et cetera? Or will that lead to, you know, another load of difficulties in terms of outcomes for, you know, for members and proper governance, their pension savings? So I think, you know, that stuff's really, you know, is worth remembering. As regards the bigger schemes, I'd agree with Kim. I think there are, you know, there is evidence of lots of good schemes that are operating out there that aren't necessarily anywhere near the £5 billion mark. And, you know, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see in due time if this comes out as to sort of why that sort of threshold of £5 billion as the upper end mark has been chosen by government in terms of its call for evidence of this next stage. I think that if it's that big, and as Kim, I think, again, has indicated, £5 billion would be bigger than you know, a number of the master trusts, you know, are themselves at this stage that have only just received authorisation, then, you know, you could see the consolidation of the market into a relatively small number of players. And then that must start to raise questions about, you know, will that stifle innovation? Will that be a good thing for consumers? Will it become harder to negotiate terms with the master trusts, etc., with less competition in the market than there was before? And finally, just remembering that all of these things are horses for courses, but, you know, there are advantages to well-run occupational pension schemes in terms of the, you know, the personal touch they can offer, you know, with the workforce and the employees that they apply to, and the tailoring of the benefit and investment package for those people that are working there, and that shouldn't necessarily be forgotten in the sort of you know, the rush to sort of move everybody into much bigger funds.
I'd like to move us on to our third topic. So this is about the pensions dashboard. The pensions dashboard project is making a lot of progress. There's been a number of recent announcements. The pensions dashboard program revealed recently that 7 software providers, administrators and pension providers will be taking part in the first test of the dashboard. It also will develop technology to make sure the processes are in place and to make onboarding as easy as possible. In addition, PASA, which Kim is chair of, her organisation has launched new guidance on e-administration as schemes need to get their data in order to comply with the dashboard deadline in 2023. PASA will also lead the development of conventions for matching dashboard users to their pensions. Kim, this all seems to show that the pensions dashboard's well on the way to be ready for 2023. However, there has been some criticism or scepticism from some of the industry about being able to meet the deadline. How confident are you that the planned deadline is still on track?
It's a difficult question. I think we need to just take a step back. There's been quite a lot of criticism from uninformed people on LinkedIn talking about dashboard being a failure, about it taking such a long time, etc. And also just focusing on trust-based schemes when actually it covers all pension schemes that are not in payment. That might change in future, but that's where it's starting from. The DWP, basically, it was in 2019 when it sort of kicked everything off in reality. So we have to ignore the prototype that went before, because Brexit and everything else really put a stop to anything sort of before that. And then Brexit again stopped an awful lot in 2020. So from effectively, PDP has been working since the beginning of 2020. So I think, you know, first of all, for having been going for round about 18 months, an awful lot has been achieved. I think, so just put that one to bed. One of the things that DWP did say in 2019 is that dashboards would be extensively user tested. And I think, you know, we have to keep on looking at what we can do and what we can do for consumers, because it has to be consumers, because they're not all members, because it's every pension benefit that they might have. And so looking at what is possible, and that's why we pass it once. We came up with our safe, simple, soon little three-word title to it. And that was getting fined. Because if you think about it, all international experience states that the people that will actually be using for the next 20 years or so, dashboard will be Generation X's, so people mid-1960s to 1980. Look at every piece of research from abroad. They are the people that are basically looking at dashboard because they're the ones that are starting to think about it. So everything else on, you know, your Generation Y's and Z's and all the younger people, that'll come, but that'll come later. So the majority of people, or a lot of the people that will be connecting to dashboards, will be people that have a mix of DB and DC data, pension benefit. And that then pushes back onto a lot of the trust-based world, obviously. So we have to be thinking about separating our thoughts on FIND, and that's why the data matching conventions, it's the DMC. I always think of Run DMC, but it's the DMC, which PASA is basically leading, because we're talking about safely matching. So that's getting the sensitivity and specificity, I always struggle with that word, but those two right, so that when you're matching, because if you set that bar too high, because every pension scheme has got to determine what is right for them, if you set that too high, then people just won't see it. And if you set it too low, then that's when you get the mismatching. So you've got match and mismatch, but you've also got the grey, the fuzzy, what they call fuzzy data. It could be and it couldn't be. So what we're doing, and we've got together with PLSA and ABI, to really look at what can be universally applicable to all pension schemes. That's not just trust-based, but all pension schemes. And building on the existing data matching, sort of aligning with the existing data matching protocols, and also aligning with small pots so that we're not creating lots of different ideas and processes for people to do, and aligning it with the potential regulatory regimes with FCA and TPR. And to do that, we're liaising with 11 of the leading administration software providers. So they provide software across the piece, public, private, etc., to look at what is possible. Because like you said, PEP announced the seven alpha data providers, so administrators and effectively, who are going to connect to the dashboard ecosystem from later on this year. And they'll be doing a lot of testing, but the thing is, they'll be testing on synthetic data. So, you know, well, apparently it's more sophisticated, but I think it's what we used to call dummy data, but it's more sophisticated than that. So when the beta providers come on board, so it might be the alpha providers, maybe some more beta providers, they will be testing on real data. So what we, as a group, we put together is probably going to be refined, it'd be reviewed and refined as we go through. So that by the time schemes have to connect to the dashboard, what we're looking to be able to do is have something that's universally applicable. And I think that's entirely sensible, because that takes away the sort of what data should we have. But also, if we have universally applicable data matching conventions, we can also, leading into sort of hopefully what David's going to cover in a bit, give some comfort to scheme managers and trustees that they are able to provide that data, because, you know, the data matching, it's all consistent. The call for information that PDP put out, it's going to be very, very challenging. And that's one of the reasons why the e-admin working group, PASA e-admin working group, put together that really important piece, which is, you know, the industry has got to appreciate that technology is vital for delivering pensions. And for technology to do that, you have to have good data. So it's all coming back to that foundation. Everything that we want to do, everything that government wants to do, has its basis in good data. And for too long, it has been seen as a cost. And we have to start looking at it as an investment. Just as a board of DB trustees will pay money to their investment advisor for good investment advice, they need to be investing that money to get their data right so that they can allow their members to connect and see what pensions, what pension benefit they've got. Now, there's a bit of a ramble, but it's everything is interconnected, and you just can't look at anything on itself.
And it'd be great to just to bring in David here, kind of to give a sort of a bit of a legal perspective. Obviously, the things that some of the issues that come up with the dashboard are, you know, sort of data protection. But also the potential for a member to be matched up with the wrong pots and the potential, you know, the kind of legal ramifications there. And what are your thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, well, look, this is something that's very much obviously in its infancy, and you know, we still haven't got all of the detail yet to know how this is all going to fit together. But you know, a couple of initial thoughts from me, I guess, would be that the first thing would be if something happens, there is some sort of mismatch, that the first thing you're going to be asking yourself is, well, who's actually responsible for the mismatch? Is that, have the trustees done exactly what they were required or compelled to do? So I'm assuming trustees, I'm taking an example of an occupational environment, but you know, or have they made decisions and acted negligently in some way in the decisions that they've made and the process that they've gone through in sort of trying to match people with the requests that are coming in to sort of match them. And then I guess the other thing is, what has flowed from that mismatch in terms of what loss that might have led to for people. And you know, it's not impossible to, you know, foresee in a disastrous scenario that, you know, you provide information on the wrong pot and somehow that ends up leading to somebody making a fraudulent claim to get transfer that pot out to somewhere else. I mean, would that be possible, or the existing safeguards in the process, you know, are there in place? Kim wants to jump in, I think.
Sorry, I was just waiting. The liability model is going to look really, you know, obviously it will look at that. But what you've got to think about with dashboards, there's no functionality at all. So it's pushed, you've got your identity verification, which is the same level as you have for connecting with HMRC. So that person has got to verify themselves. What they may see, if there's a mismatch, is they may see, at the moment, if you just go and find, they might see ABC pension scheme. And here are the contact details. If you go and find and view, they'll see ABC pension scheme. And currently, they'll have potentially the date of leaving benefit. If they want to do anything, they still have to go through exactly the same process as they do now. So there's absolutely no calculation ability, there's no functionality around that. Not to say that a dashboard provider can't put something around the outside, but dashboard itself is a closed unit.
Yeah, understood, Kim. But clearly, obviously, if there's an error, then that may give access to somebody to information that they otherwise would never have sort of obscene. And somebody who's mischievously minded, you know, may be able to do something, I guess, in theory, with that information.
Yes.
The other thought is, I think, is that, sort of from speaking to trustee clients, is that they sort of are the most concerned about making sure that obviously when they're going to be sharing all of this information back to the dashboards, that from a data protection perspective, that the legislation is drawn clearly to give them a safe harbour for what they're doing. So I think that is the space that we are watching and that they are watching most closely at the moment.
So we've almost come to the end of our podcast. So we're just going to quickly touch on our final subject. So this is about the pensions regulator and the Pension Protection Fund are reviewing pension schemes that might be eligible for the Fraud Compensation Fund. This follows uncertainty around instances where no independent trustee has been appointed to a scheme. This came on the back of a letter from Labour MP Stephen Timms, who is chair of the Work and Pensions Committee. He asked TPR to clarify the conditions in which pension savers were eligible for compensation. And so I just want to bring in David here just to sort of perhaps take us through this kind of very briefly about, you know, what this could potentially mean, the outcome of the review. Could it mean that all schemes should have to appoint an independent trustee to be able to make a claim? And also why this has sort of come out now?
Yeah, so this, I think, follows on. So let's reverse back. So obviously, this the Poor Compensation Fund exists as a vehicle to pay compensation to occupational pension schemes where assets have been reduced because of acts of dishonesty. And up until sort of late last year, the amounts paid out had been relatively modest, something like £5 million since the fund was established under the Pensions Act 2004. But in the autumn of last year, we got a judgment from the High Court which clarified a number of the eligibility conditions for making claims on the FCF, and the judge made clear that there should be a fairly wide interpretation drawn to those gateway provisions to allow claims to be made. So I think that had already made a significant impact on the number of claims that might be made, and as part of that judgment we know that the PPF said that they were aware of potentially about £350 million worth of claims being out there in the wings, and say compare that to the £5 million that had been, you know, paid out to date. What this latest correspondence is a further refinement of some of the eligibility really for making claims, and that's in relation to those schemes where Stephen Timms is asking if there's no sort of trustees or functioning trustees in place or any scheme assets, do they in theory still are eligible to make claims on the FCF? And the joint response from the PPF and TPR is saying, in principle, the legislation wouldn't necessarily require there to be a trustee in place. But of course, the process that you need to go through in order to make a claim on the FCF, which requires somebody to sort of be gathering together the evidence of the dishonesty in the first place, and then valuing the claim and making efforts to recover the lost assets, etc. All of that, and then of course that the compensation itself has to be paid to the scheme, not to the members who've lost out, and therefore there needs to be somebody to distribute those compensation monies. All of those things in practice mean that a trustee is needed. The reality is, I think that there probably is an independent trustee already appointed to a significant number of these schemes. And I think what the correspondence indicates is that TPR will be reviewing again whether for those schemes that where a trustee hasn't been appointed, whether it's now an appropriate time to look again at that and whether it should exercise its powers to appoint one.
Thank you so much for that, David. And thank you so much to David and to Kim also for taking part in the podcast. And this brings us to the end of the programme. We will be back in 2 weeks' time for the next episode of the Pensions Expert podcast. See you then.